Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, February 11th, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about some news items, and then we'll present an interview with Michael Gracie, the writer and director of Better Man. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
All right, Jacob, full disclosure, we're actually recording this a few days early. So if any wild news happens in the intervening time, that's why we're not talking about it. I'm sure we'll get to it on a future episode. But it has been a little while since we've dipped into the news of what's going on in Hollywood. So I thought it would be interesting to start this episode with just a little bit of a news catch up. And two big things that happened in the past couple days were the release of a few notable trailers. So Fantastic Four, The First Steps came out, and Jurassic World Rebirth also had a trailer debut. So I just wanted to get your temperature on what you thought about these two trailers. So let's start with Fantastic Four. What'd you make of that one?
I'm a Fantastic Four super fan. They're my favorite Marvel team. I love those characters. I love that they're sci-fi adventurers first and superheroes second. So I approach these characters with a certain level of reverence. I think this trailer is okay. I think there's some cool visuals in here. I love the 60s aesthetics. I love that they've just really gone full-throated for that retro look. That, to me, is very important to these characters. But this reeks of a trailer where they're really cutting around what footage do we have ready for a movie that has a ton of work left to be finished on it. This is a kind of trailer that you cut to be ready for the Super Bowl, not because you're ready to actually show anything. So I'm excited for this movie. I'm really hoping that it gives the MCU the shot in the arm that it so desperately needs, because these characters have never gotten their due on the big screen. I mean, the Corbin film from the 90s is famously, you know, intentionally awful because it was made to, you know, hold on to rights and never be released. But the two other live action films from the early 2000s and then the reboot from 10 years ago, they're all just real bad movies. And goodness, Ben, I would love a good Fantastic Four movie. And I would love to say this trailer filled me full of unbridled hope, but instead it filled me full of, oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm in a similar boat. I'm wondering if you think Fantastic Four is just a superhero team or concept that doesn't have the same level of juice as some of the other ones that Marvel has explored on the big screen over the years. Because as you've just laid out, we've seen multiple at-bats for bringing this story to life on the big screen, and it just hasn't really worked out. So, like, is this going to be an instance of continuing that trend, or is this going to be the thing that turns it around? Do people in general care about the Fantastic Four? I know comic book readers, like people who grew up reading comics, have a real affinity for these characters, and I just wonder if this might be one of those groups that just works better on the page than it does in live action.
Yeah, that's my concern. I don't know if regular people like this team. I mean, these four are characters who I love on the page, but does the average person like Ben Grimm, aka the Thing, in the same way they like Spider-Man? Of course they don't. Marvel has to find a way to broaden the appeal of these characters and make them really stand out to ordinary folks. And is a 60s aesthetic the way they do that? I don't know. I think it's cool. I think it's a cool choice. I love the swing. But man, I just don't know, Ben. I just don't know. And I would have loved to have felt some kind of certainty after this trailer. Instead, I feel less certain than ever.
All right, so we'll definitely be checking back in with that as it gets a little bit closer to release. Jurassic World Rebirth had a trailer as well. I think it was on the heels of a big Vanity Fair article where it interviewed some of the folks involved with making the movie. And I know you and I were both very impressed by the things that the filmmakers and the actors were saying in that piece. So compare and contrast what you felt reading that article, which had them talking about wanting to bring Jurassic Park or Jurassic World or this franchise back into its horror roots, and then what you felt actually watching the trailer. Did you think the trailer did a good job of capturing the same tone that these filmmakers indicated that they were going for in that big profile piece?
Sort of. There definitely seems to be a, a lot of dinosaurs in this movie, which is A plus. There seems to be a lot of, you know, intense encounters with the dinosaurs, also A plus. As was recounted in our Slack by a lot of people, there are a lot of wisecracks in this trailer that land with a thud. I'm not opposed to wisecracks. I think they're, when you do them right, they're fine. But something about the tone of this trailer, the contrast between scary dinosaurs and people essentially going, you know, uh-oh, that's a thing that happened. It didn't work for me. I think Gareth Edwards is a really interesting filmmaker. I like all of his movies. Rogue One, Godzilla, and Monsters are all terrific. Oh, and also, I guess, the Creator, which is a movie that I don't like as much, but I think is a really ambitious thing. So I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt here. I actually liked his trailer more than the trailer for Fantastic Four, which is a surprising thing for me to say. But I went from being pumped after the Vanity Fair article to being like very curious after the trailer.
Okay. Yeah, I think the visuals look pretty impressive. There's that one scene that reminds me a lot of the scene in the beginning of Godzilla where somebody is trapped behind a glass wall and there seems to be a dinosaur in whatever containment facility that they're in with them, and it's all bathed in red lights, and it just reminds me very much of the aesthetic of the first the sort of Bryan Cranston sequence of that 2014 Godzilla movie. But I'm sort of cautiously optimistic. I think I'm pretty much in the same boat as you, so this is not exactly interesting podcasting when we're both exactly sort of aligned on these things, but that's where we stand nonetheless. I wanted to shout out that we wrote a separate article about how this movie is going to be finally adapting the scariest scene from the original book that was not in Steven Spielberg's original movie. So if you want to know more about that, just click on the article that I'll link to in the show notes. All right, three more news stories here. This one, we don't really have much to go on, but a story came out not too long ago that Ryan Gosling has joined an upcoming Star Wars movie from director Sean Levy. And once again, that's pretty much all we know. But what do you think about this, Jacob? That's obviously Gosling, pretty huge name, and this is not something that that Star Wars fans are taking lightly, I'm guessing.
Yeah, this to me is evidence that Star Wars can't rely on Star Wars anymore. I mean, Star Wars has become saturated to the point where people seem to be like shrugging off entire new shows, good ones and bad ones, in a way that I don't think anybody saw coming 10 years ago. If you told me, you know, 10 years ago, people would watch 6 episodes of a new Star Trek show and shrug it off entirely or completely skip it, I would have been flabbergasted. Like, this is Star Wars. This is the biggest deal on Earth. And the past, you know, decade plus has seen Star Wars no longer be the biggest deal on Earth. And I love Ryan Gosling, and I'm excited to see what he can do here. But this to me really feels like Star Wars realizing, do we need stars now? Do we need like Harrison Ford level people to come in and boost the brand again? I don't know. What do you think, Ben? Like, are you optimistic at all about Star Wars at this point in its history?
I think there's a chance for it to regain maybe not the full dominance that it once held in the culture, but at least like return to a level of quality that we haven't seen in a little while. And it's just so weird the way that Lucasfilm has been handling the movies. I mean, obviously, we haven't seen a Star Wars movie since 2019, and that was a movie that you and I both hated with almost every fiber of our being. So like, and that's coming off of The Last Jedi, which we both loved. So like, talk about a roller coaster, high and low experience right there. And then it's just been nothing really on the big screen since then. So I'm so curious to see what happens. I have like zero interest in the Mandalorian and Grogu movie because I don't really like the Mandalorian as a show. So I'm excited about like, I want to like Star Wars stuff again, and I love Ryan Gosling as a performer. So this seems like it has the potential to maybe be, you know, something that could attract me back and get me excited about this again. Sean Levy's involvement, I'm a little more mixed on, but he's directed some good stuff. So I'm not ready to write him off.
He's your definition of a working everyman director. He comes in, he shoots a script that's given to him, and he benefits so hugely from the right collaborators. He's just there to get things shot in the can on time and on budget. And sometimes that works and sometimes it absolutely does not.
Yeah. He's directed some, I mean, Real Steel is one that I really like. Even the Night at the Museum movies are like very good for what they are. You know, they're not trying to be more than more than what they're supposed to be. And he directed some great episodes of Stranger Things. So like, you know, there's definitely some potential there. So we'll see how that goes. I'm really curious to know what you think about Robert Eggers, who is one of your favorite working directors. This piece came out, this was, let's see, January 23rd, so a couple weeks ago now, where Robert Eggers has been hired to co-write and direct a sequel to the Jim Henson movie Labyrinth. So what was your reaction when you heard this news, Jacob?
Strangely enough, I thought this is a perfect marriage of filmmaker and material, because on the surface, Robert Eggers, you know, this gothic horror approach seems very different from Jim Henson. But Henson was always trying to push his field in different directions. And maybe Muppets paid the bills, of course, but, you know, Dark Crystal and Labyrinth were examples of him really trying to push boundaries of who he was as a filmmaker and the type of tone and stories he could tell with his expertise. And Eggers, even though he does utilize CGI in his film, especially in Nosferatu, is a very tactile filmmaker. He wants you to feel and smell his movies in a way that I think a lot of filmmakers aren't always as deeply interested in. And the sort of tactility of Eggers' film makes me think that there's no way he makes a Labyrinth movie and doesn't actively embrace Henson of it all, doesn't actively like bring in puppets and suits and animatronics. So otherwise, what's the point? And I know that he's doing this after he does his werewolf movie called Werewolf for Focus Features. So I love that Eggers is continuing to do his Eggers thing while also, you know, taking on what looks like his first major studio gig. So good for him, first of all. But yeah, I think that if you look at The Witch or The Lighthouse, you walk away from those movies feeling like you've been in a place, been with those characters. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same about Henson movies, whether it's a happy film, like a Muppet film, or something more sinister. I feel like that's what they have in common. I feel like the sense of putting you in a world surrounded by things you feel like you can touch is vital to both them as filmmakers. And so strangely, I think it's perfect. I mean, I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, that's a great call. I do wonder how he's going to handle the tone, because a lot of his movies are pretty, what is the word? Maybe severe would be a word, like a pretty
sinister maybe.
Yeah. And that is not exactly the tone of a sort of family friendly type of thing. So just on like a curiosity level, like how the hell is this guy who makes movies where, I mean, I don't want to describe the last shot of Nosferatu in case people haven't gotten around to seeing that yet. But holy cow, like, you know, what a gut punch, a powerful imagery. You know, this guy who's so great at crafting incredible, searing imagery. How does he transition into a family-friendly environment? Just does not seem like something that is in his personality or his interest set. But yeah, the tactility that you're talking about, I think, makes him a really interesting fit on a visual level. So I hope that it comes together, and this is not one of those projects that just gets announced but never actually comes to fruition. So
just like curiosity, how long has it been since you've seen Labyrinth?
Oh man, probably 10 years at least. Oh, actually, now that I think about it, 10 years ago is 2015. Man, I do that sometimes, you know, like time keeps on ticking. Yeah. And I'm like, oh yeah, 10 years ago. It's probably been 15 years at least. So what about you?
It's been maybe a few years, but it's one of my wife's favorite movies. So I've seen it quite often. And I think it's more sinister and stranger and more unpleasant than you may remember. It's a weird, dark movie. So if they are true to what Labyrinth was, then they'll actually, it may be less family friendly than we're all anticipating, to be honest.
Okay. Awesome. All right. So the last news story here that I think is really notable is that a Buffy the Vampire Slayer sequel series could actually happen, with Chloe Zhao, the director of Nomadland and The Eternals, attached to potentially direct the pilot. She's going to be executive producing the show. And maybe more notably than anything else is that Sarah Michelle Gellar is in final talks to return to reprise her role as Buffy. This show is going to be about a new Slayer, and she's going to have more of a recurring role, Sarah Michelle Gellar. But I mean, wow, like talk about a bomb dropped into the pop culture zeitgeist. Like, the original Buffy is not a show that I have any relationship to, but so many people that I like and work with and respect and, you know, admire their taste and all of that, grew up watching the show. And it's an incredibly important series to a lot of people. And it comes with a lot of baggage because of Joss Whedon's involvement. He is not involved at all in this new version, which is going to be written by Nora and Lily Zuckerman. I think that's their name, or Lila. And they're the showrunners for Rian Johnson and Natasha Lyonne's Poker Face show on Peacock. So, Jacob, I think you have more of a relationship to Buffy than I do, certainly, which is zero. But what was your gut reaction when you saw this, and especially when you heard that Whedon was not going to be involved?
Yeah, Buffy's a top five show for me. It's one of my favorite shows of all time. It's ridiculously important to me. It is in my DNA. And one of the big issues is that that show is Whedon. Like, we can talk about what a scumbag he is, what an abusive jerk he is, how he hurt people, but there's kind of no denying the talent of him as a writer and storyteller, and his fingerprints are all over that show. Like, that show is so much of him. So I'm glad he's not involved in this new one. Like, he genuinely probably shouldn't work again based on the stories of how he treated people. But also, it makes me wonder what is Buffy without him, and I'm very curious for that question to be answered. And I'm really curious, if Sarah Michelle Gellar was willing to come back for it, then clearly someone is saying the right thing or writing enough zeros on the check. I have such complicated feelings here, Ben, because Buffy is such a perfect little show. It's seven seasons, you know, starts off a little too goofy, ends a little too tired, but seasons 2 through 6 are some of my favorite television of all time. It is the right mixture of comedy, horror, and soap opera. It's such a product of the 90s, but in all the right ways. And there have been a lot of comic book sequels to Buffy. They did season 8, season 9, season 10 in comic book form, and they were all largely pretty terrible. And so I'm excited to see those get wiped out of existence, out of canon. And I'm excited to see Sarah Michelle Gellar take on the Giles role. Giles was the mentor figure in the original show, who like sort of guided Buffy on her missions. And I think that putting her in that position is really smart. But I really, really think they need to try to capture the tone of the original without Whedon. I think that they can't say we reject all Whedon principles because he's a scumbag. They need to really look at why people embrace that show. The dialogue, the storytelling, the rip your heart out reveals, the willingness to go full romance when they needed to. I mean, Buffy was romantic vampires, you know, done right years before Twilight was a huge thing. And I'm really hoping that they manage to find that really tricky balance of the show, Ben. Because, Ben, the show was the kind of show where one episode could be the goofiest Power Rangers camp imaginable. And next episode could be a rip your heart out drama that deals with death and devastation and mourning in ways that never felt cheap or forced. And that's the kind of thing you could do so well in 90s era TV when you had a 22 episode season. You could spread your wings and try things. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know how that tone of show would function in a streaming era where you have 8 episodes to make your point. So yeah, I'm excited, I'm intrigued, but I'm nervous because there's so many volatile things at play here. And that volatility is what made Buffy so intriguing and fun to watch, and that's why I'm passionate about it, because Buffy is 1,000 different things, and a streaming show these days can be like 2 things.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it goes. I'm sure we'll be talking more about that in terms of casting and stuff like that as more announcements come out in the coming months and potentially years. I'm not sure what the timeline is looking like for when they're going to be able to actually start production on this thing, but stay tuned. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll get back into our Better Man discussion and your interview with Michael Gracie.
Your old or broken phone can let you down, but at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence with a new line on MyPlan and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. After all, you don't want your old phone to die on you when you're lost.
Perfect.
Or for your broken phone to glitch at the worst possible time.
Hey, can I get your number?
Oh. Trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad.
Okay, Jacob, I finally saw Better Man. You and Rian talked about this last year. Jeremy convinced me to watch it during our big 50 best movie moments podcast thing when he was talking about the Lord of the Rings-esque fight sequence that happens near the end of the movie. We're going to do full spoilers for Better Man at this point, so we can talk about every aspect of it. So if you've not seen the movie yet, go check it out, because I was very hesitant to watch this, and I watched it by myself in a theater the last day that it was in theaters near me, and found myself in tears in the theater multiple times. And I just was not expecting to be emotionally moved to the degree that I was watching this movie. Like, I was not prepared based on the trailers and not knowing a damn thing about Robbie Williams. And basically, you guys were validated. Like, everything that you're saying was right. You're vindicated in your support for this movie.
Ryan is deeply wrong.
Yes, yes. I mean, man, like, this movie sounds like it's really been sticking with you. Like, you saw it months and months ago. What are your thoughts about it now?
Last time we talked about it, before you saw it, I was hedging and hemming and hawing about, is this in my top 10? And decided no. And now, weeks later, I'm like, Better Man should have been in my top 10 of 2024. It should have been in there. It should maybe be the number 10 spot. It deserves it. This movie has really stuck to my ribs. I think about it a lot. I keep watching the clips of the various musical numbers on YouTube because I don't have access to the movie yet. But by the time you're listening to this episode, it's going to be available on digital and VOD and whatnot. But right now, I'm anxious to watch it again, because the stuff that I was kind of baffled by but enjoyed months ago has really solidified and crystallized. And in the interview, you'll hear me talk about this with Michael Gracie. Because when I first watched Fantastic Fest, it was a secret screening. I didn't know who Robbie Williams was. I thought it was a fictional biopic about a monkey man. I was so confused, but baffled, but also kind of amazed by it. But with full context, some of the choices that I thought were admirable but silly now really resonate with me. Like the idea of, why is this Robin Williams biopic starring a motion capture ape? And like I said, you'll hear this discussion in the interview. But the idea of, so many biopics are about artists who don't like themselves, who see themselves as other, who look in the mirror and hate what they see. And so often we watch those and go, oh yeah, but that's still Timothée Chalamet. That's still a handsome actor we like. By turning the main character into a visual effect, Better Man allows us into the mindset of somebody who sees themselves as a creature or different or an other at all times. And even though you kind of get used to special effect after a while, to the first 15 minutes, you accept, oh yeah, he's a motion capture monkey, and I'm just going to accept that. It never allows you to forget that he himself sees himself as different. And he himself mm-hmm. never feels like he fits in. So in addition to like really spectacular musical numbers and like so much style, this movie like has style, and even the most mundane moments is doing something cool with the camera. It's a constant heartbreaking reminder that the main character never feels at home in any moment of his life. And what initially seems like a silly, goofy choice ends up being one that has really gut punched me repeatedly the more I think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And just like the relationship with his dad, which is like on paper something that I've seen a million times and can predict practically every beat of, you know, it's just so exceptionally done. It's so exceptionally executed that I just found myself welling up in the theater. And the relationship with his grandmother too, like this one woman who sort of sees past this artifice and seems to look at him as a real human being, where everybody else kind of looks at him as this outsider. It's just this, it's so simple, it's primal, if you'll excuse the pun, primal filmmaking that just really, really capital W worked for me. So I don't really know what else to say than that, but man, just a really shockingly surprising movie. And I cannot recommend enough, if you were put off by the trailers or just decided to skip this, like, rectify that situation, because I think you'll be surprised with what you see. So
yeah, I say this, to Michael Gracie in the interview, but I haven't felt this way about movies in Speed Racer, a film that everybody skipped in theaters that didn't get a lot of critical love, but everybody who saw it walked away going, wait, was that a masterpiece? Wait, what? And so I kind of feel like Better Man has that Speed Racer DNA, where it's like, in 10 years everybody's gonna say, oh, it was great, and we'll acknowledge it as great. And we'll all kind of forget the moment where it was a giant bomb.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so here is Jacob's conversation with writer-director Michael Gracie.
I saw this at Fantastic Fest last year when it was a secret screening, so we didn't know what it was. And as an American, I was unfamiliar with Robbie Williams. So I spent the entire movie thinking, is this a fictional biopic about a fictional thing? So I love the movie, but I was like, I was baffled, like, man, what is this thing? And I'm wondering if you would have thought about that, thought about me, the dumb American who doesn't know Robbie Williams is, when you're making this movie, if that crossed your mind.
I did. To be honest, I almost like people who don't know anything about Robbie Williams. That's a more interesting audience for me because, you know, it's kind of like A Star Is Born. Like, is the character that Bradley Cooper plays real or is he fictional? Like, you just buy into it because you invest in that character. And I kind of go, in a world where Robbie Williams didn't exist, I would still love to tell this story, you know? So it's hard for the fact that, I think there was some desire to sort of trying to explain who Robbie Williams was, but that was never a concern for me. Meaning if you watch the film and you bought into the character and you go on this journey at the end, if you're like, let me just check out if this guy's for real. The fact that he is real is kind of a part two, you know, like it doesn't necessarily need to come into the viewing. But it may stop you from going to see it, you know? So you saw it at a screening where you didn't know you were going to end up watching it.
Yeah. I had no idea what I was in for.
Yeah. Which is, I kind of love that too, because again, I think that's been some of the best responses because I think it's hard for people to go, I don't know anything about Roy Williams, so why do I care about this film? Mm-hmm. But you sort of go, well, it's irrelevant, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I keep telling people. The closest thing I can think of is Wachowski's Speed Racer from 2008, a movie that was unsung at its time, and now everybody agrees, oh, I think it was a masterpiece. It was pushing visuals. It was pushing what movies do. And like, we all agree on that now. We didn't agree in 2008. I saw that in theaters and can tell you right away, people were like, what is that movie? I'm not going to see that. And I keep on saying to people, if you like Speed Racing, you should probably check out Better Man.
That's really funny. Yeah, look, I think it's going to be interesting with the digital release. I think more people are going to meet it. And that, for me, is exciting because I think when people see it, their enthusiasm for it is quite, it's one of those things where I don't think the difficulty is people are quite effusive and talk about it after they've seen it. Mm-hmm. It's getting people to see it has been the struggle, you know?
Yeah. And you know, the big marquee thing here, of course, is the fact that Robbie Williams is portrayed as a motion capture ape. And after sitting on the movie for these months, what resonates with me the most about that choice is not that it's just a daring, bold visual choice, but the idea of how do you represent a character's body dysmorphia on screen when they think they're ugly, when they think they're worthless, when they think they're different at all times? You can put a handsome actor in that role and you can just go, oh yeah, but they're still handsome. But when you use visual effects to create their inner life like that, it changes it fundamentally. Can you talk about that choice?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all those things you said. I think that the being other, the being different and seeing yourself that way, seeing yourself not worthy, all of these things, you know, and I, to be honest, you know, people have asked me, like, do you think the film would have done better if it wasn't, you know, if it didn't have a monkey as the lead? And I'm like, well, I have no interest in making that version of the film. Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing that interested me in this was the exploration of this monkey trying to navigate, you know, the world. And it is, you know, it's about, you know, how Rob sees himself, but it's also, it allows something that, you know, that I really would love to explore more in film just moving forward, which is, you know, this being a musical, you're already in a heightened place, you know, like the real world doesn't burst into song. And then to add a monkey on top of that, you're in quite a heightened space. Like it's a really heightened world, quite a theatrical world. So to step between and knowing that I wanted to explore both Rob's external life and his internal life, being able to step between a heightened reality and then what's going on inside Rob's head, which is fantasy, that distance is quite short. It's not disruptive for the audience at all to go from the real world and then go to the fantastical world. And to be able to transition between the real world and the fantastical, kind of that seamlessly or effortlessly, I should say, I really enjoyed that. Like, I really enjoyed, just from a narrative point of view, being able to do that. Because the thing about a musical is you're singing your internal thoughts and your internal feelings. You're already putting words to what's going on inside. So to be able to put visuals to that and not be disruptive in terms of an audience, I think is wonderful. Like, I really enjoyed that. So again, the monkey just allows you to do that in a way that an audience will really go with you once they've bought into the conceit, you know.
Yeah, and I think people buy into it pretty quickly. I think 15 minutes in, I'd stopped looking at visual effect. I was like, oh, that's Robbie. He looks like that in this world, and he feels different because of it.
Everyone.
But the thing is, when you get through that movie, the ape choice is not the most startling choice in the movie. Every sequence in this film is stylized to the point where like I had to like take a deep breath while watching, going, wow, that was hell of a scene. So how do you approach sequences like any musical numbers, but also sequences that in a regular biopic would have been fairly boilerplate, but instead you film them with such style and creativity that it feels like you're reinventing what a biopic can feel like. Can you talk about approaching that choice and trying to make sure you didn't exhaust the audience while making sure you kept every moment that stimulating?
Yeah, I mean it's really interesting. I mean, I think that the you sort of go, these are the song choices, and then I always say you sing when words no longer suffice. So the dramatic scenes leading up to a song are either taking you up to sort of a moment of euphoria and you break into song, or you're going into the depths of despair and then you break into song. So narratively, what you're doing is you're ratcheting up to the point where you start singing emotionally. But what that allows you to do is you sort of in those scenes, you get to really craft visually that journey, you know. So if he's having a here the fight with the boys and he gets kicked out of the band, and then you go, so then he's driving away and he's angry and he's looking at the house in his rear vision mirror, and so you want to capture all of this in the moment, and you kind of want to stay with him because you're about to go into his head. So you're staying inside the car, you're sort of getting this guy who's sort of starting to unwind, mentally. And then he bursts through the gates, almost gets hit by a car, and dives into the fog. And you kind of go, is that the fog of his mind? And as an audience, you go, that could be real fog, you know? But it also could be him going into the fog of him spiraling, you know? And then the fog, there's sort of red flares by the side of the road, and you're starting to go, okay, now we're sort of going a little bit into either there's an accident coming up or we're going into the emergency place in his head. And then by the time the whole world is now glowing red, you're like, okay, I feel like I'm well and truly inside, the mind of Robbie as he sort of spirals out of control. And then by the time the bus shows up with his dad singing on it, which we've seen from when his dad left him when he was 7 years old, you're 100% convinced, okay, now we have had a break from reality. And then bang, a wall of water, and he goes smashing through it. And then the underwater sequence plays out where very clearly we're in his mind in a moment of, real pain for the guy. Because just talking with someone and knowing that he made a decision at 21 where, he left Take That, a boy band, and they had to set up hotlines all over the world because girls were killing themselves because of, at 21 he left a boy band. Like, that's a lot for a 21-year-old to live with. And at the same time, just being constantly harassed by the paparazzi. And so you sort of go, all of this to say that as a director, when you want to represent that narrative, because it always just comes down to the narrative, like, what am I trying to tell? What part of the story am I trying to tell? Yeah, you just want to push yourself to try and put something on screen that, is unique and powerful, you know? So that was the driving thing, and I think You know, a lot of it comes down to which, you know, I'm not, I'm the first to say, like, it totally inspired by Bob Fosse in the way that he choreographs a camera. But it was very much like, how do I choreograph the camera to capture the, you know, these moments in a way that feels powerful?
And the visual metaphor reaches climax at the big festival sequence at the end of the film, where we literally see a man's self-loathing take the form of a fantasy battle. I would love to know the origin of that and how you chose to stage it, because I can think of some inspirations that like I saw in it, but I'm curious to hear where you drew your take from it from.
Yeah, and to me it was like the idea of fighting yourself is something I think we're all familiar with, and I think that you know, it's sort of like you said, you get an idea of that self-loathing and that self-judgment going on through every performance that he does. He's always kind of clocking himself out in the audience, looking on in disgust. And so it does reach, it reaches this point at Nebworth, which is interesting because you go in your head, oh, this is obviously this guy's greatest moment of his life. You know, he's performing to 125,000 people. He did it 3 nights in a row. He broke every record at the time. And you're just like, this is what you think is someone's, you know, greatest moment of happiness. Where he's fulfilling all his dreams, and yet at the time it was an absolute nightmare. And you know, Robbie doesn't remember that performance at all, which to me speaks to how checked out he was mentally. Like it's incredible to have one of the greatest moments you could ever experience and not remember it. And so, you know, he I love the idea of him jumping in. There's a film called Queen Margot, Lorraine and Margot, which is a French film. And the reason I love the sword fights in that is that there's a weight to the sword, and things feel like they're fighting so long that there's like real fatigue. Like by the end, he's with this guy and he can't even lift his sword to strike him. And it felt so dirty and so visceral. And I referenced that a lot. I had to cut the sequence down because I really wanted to give it a sense of that, the weight of the sword and everything. But it was just running a bit long. So I didn't get to play out that idea as much as I initially planned and initially choreographed for. And then there's stuff like Battle of the Bastards and, you know, Lord of the Rings and just the classic fight sequences that were, but really it was like, what is it like when you're trying to take on everything? You know, like everything's coming at you from every angle, everything's piling in on top of you. And so I sort of wanted the, almost like you know, I described it like waves crashing on you in terms of the, if you see the way the battle takes place, it's almost like two waves coming in and crashing down on top of him. So there was sort of almost like an oceanic feel to the crowd and the fight. And that sort of thing of drowning in self-loathing, you know, drowning in so all of those words and visuals were sort of talked about a lot when we were putting that sequence together. And then obviously, you know, it comes to quite an abrupt halt when he kills his younger self, which is based on, you know, going to rehab and one of the sort of techniques that where they show you a photo of your younger self, you know, like age 5 or 6, and basically say, would you be doing what you're doing to this little boy? And of course, the people are like, no, I freaking love that kid, as if I would do this to that boy. And they're like, well, that's you know. And so I really like that idea of him confronting his younger self, because there's an innocence and a part of us that will always love that young, innocent version of ourself.
All right. Well, I have 100 more questions, but I'm out of time. Thank you so much. The
Shit,
movie is,
really?
yeah, the movie's
Sorry,
really,
man.
really great, and I'm really happy that people are finding it. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Great to
All right.
talk to you.
All right, that'll do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all the news stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you tomorrow.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI. And a watch and tab on any plan, only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan, service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.